get serious about building content sites and building a profitable business online? Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. We bring you the latest field-tested tips, tricks, and strategies for building a profitable online asset. We interview industry experts, share customer success stories, and reveal our own experiences working on hundreds of sites to inspire and motivate you to make something happen. Let's do this.
Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. Today we have Aisha Priest. Now, if some of you maybe have seen some of her content before on her Instagram or Twitter or other podcasts she's been on, she's essentially now a digital nomad making a living from her niche website portfolio. And we dive into how she makes her money on her niche website, specifically her main website and her second website, which has recently taken off. And we dive into some of the specifics around those. I think what's most valuable out of this podcast is not just kind of the case study around the size, but more so her processes and thought processes around her writing team, how she hires them, how she manages them, and also just general mindset around building your niche sites as well. She gives some great advice for anyone who's struggling with building their sites, or maybe someone who's starting their sites and feeling a little demotivated, not seeing the progress that they think they should be getting. So sit back and enjoy.
This episode is brought to you by Niche Website Builders, an agency dedicated to helping people just like you build profitable content sites. Niche Website Builders are the hands-off content site marketing agency you always wished existed. It's run by content site marketers for content site marketers, and they help both investors and individuals alike build profitable online properties. They provide a fully outsourced approach to content creation, link building, and done-for-you website builds, the same approach they use on their own six-figure portfolios. For example, their content packages come with a proprietary keyword research process, are written by in-house native English speakers, formatted using templates proven to convert, and uploaded to WordPress with affiliate links added so that all you need to do is hit the publish button. Check them out at nichewebsite.builders/show. That's nichewebsite.builders/show and fill out the form to get coupon codes for 10% more content or a 10% discount on links with your first order sent right to your inbox.
All right, welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. Today we have Aisha Priest. I got that completely wrong. Great way to start the podcast. Sorry about that. Welcome, Aisha.
Thank you so much for having me, James. You're not the first person that made that mistake. I think my own family sometimes mess it up, so don't worry about it.
it's a good start to the podcast anyway. Break the ice there. So I guess you've done a little bit of the podcast rounds as well before, so people might be familiar with who you are and your story and background, but maybe just for people who haven't, do you want to provide a brief background about who you are, what you're doing, and kind of, I guess, how you got into the whole SEO niche website space?
Yeah, I'll keep it brief. So basically, I grew up and studied law, fell into finance for 10 years, and then started various side hustles, fell into blogging, started my first blog, made a lot of mistakes, managed to turn it around and, you know, got to 100,000 page views in 7 months after I put my mind to it. It earns me between $10,000 to $15,000 a month. And now I own a portfolio of 6 niche sites. I run my own team. But this growth has been only in the last 2 years. And so it's been a lot of failing, analysis paralysis to get to this point. And I'm still learning, and I'm happy to share my challenges and struggles with all of you so you know that it's okay to fail your way through it to get there to the end, you know, whatever the end is.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned you made a whole lot of mistakes on your first site. So you've obviously learned from that since that site's doing very well and you've got now a portfolio. Are there specific things that you could rattle off that you made mistakes on that you were able to correct, and now that's kind of like the way you do things going forward?
Great question. Absolutely. So I think the first thing is, and everybody talks about this, but it is topical authority when you do keyword research. And I actually made this mistake with my second site, which I'm sure we're going to go into. I went and started it by talking about various different topics, right? And I realized, and saying at the beginning of my second site, I would write about many different areas, but I realized Google needs to trust you. And to do that, you need to write a cluster of content. And so now with the rest of my sites, I go in there with clusters, number one. And number two is the big mistake I made was I didn't know SEO. I didn't understand it. And I wish that I learned it from the beginning. And number three is you've got to get the foundation right. And so what do I mean by that? It's have a sparse theme, try and pass the bare minimum. I mean, everybody goes on about core web vitals being really important, but just think about the user experience. How can we make it easy for our readers to read and engage with your content? And finally, and I'm finding this is really, really helping me, is just writing like you would talk to somebody. And I'm noticing the difference between, I think I mentioned at the beginning, my third site got hit, and I think the difference is, the content where I actually just talk to them and say, hey, are you struggling to find this microphone? And really speaking to them as a human, mentioning their mistakes, as opposed to, here are seven best microphones. And so talking to them as a human being. And actually, finally, the biggest thing is content, content, content. When in doubt, it's content. Because you are running an online content business, right? Your product is your content. And often I get people saying to me, oh, I think I'm a failure. I don't know why this isn't working. And they have 30 pieces of content. How is Google going to trust you? You haven't built your digital house yet. And so using those principles is helping me build my niche sites.
I like that idea of the talking to the person almost like a conversation, because I guess you can get into the frame of mind, hey, I just need SEO optimized content. It's just going to help whatever these keywords are. Cool. But then I've recently fallen in love with the idea of copywriting and almost like words. And I don't know how it sounds geeky as hell. And I used to hate writing, but now I'm like, I can't believe that you could literally change a few words on a sentence and you can suddenly sell a whole lot of stuff. So in terms of the conversational piece, like how are you writing something that's more conversational than just say, here are the 10 best microphones, whatever, whatever. Are you doing things like maybe putting like really short sentences, like a few words with like dot, 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 and then like a new line and maybe like almost like something you've spoken like yes or no, like on like one line itself instead of having just short paragraphs all the way through?
Actually, you're way more technical than me. I don't even go that far. For me, it's like, okay, let's give me a practical example. Microphones for podcasters, just random example. No idea if it's a good keyword. What are the pain points? What is the thought process of somebody who is Googling best podcasters, best microphones for podcasters? So I'll say, are you worried that the quality of your recording is going to embarrass you? Are you concerned that all your competitors have really crisp content, but you can't afford the expensive content? Are you really rubbish at tech and don't want 100 million different softwares? Talk to them and think about the pain points and draw attention to it and say, hey, I get you. Like if you told me I'm looking for a best microphone for a podcast, I'd be like, okay, why? You know, oh, you know, this, and this. And then just getting into the head and talking to them as a human really builds that relationship with them.
Yeah, and it stops your content being bland. Because
there's
a lot of that.
Yeah, and it's okay. And it's okay to add personality to your content. It's perfectly fine.
Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned, obviously, you write in clusters now. So you used to kind of, maybe you have five categories and you maybe write two on this category, one in another category, the following day, etc. Do you have maybe a process within that cluster that you write your content? For example, are you still going, hey, I'm trying to attack the low competition stuff, maybe the lower search volume because that is lower competition in that cluster? Or are you just like, I don't care, I'm just trying to hit everything as quick as possible?
So it's certainly the low competition, but it also depends on the site. So my first site is more well-established. It's got a higher domain authority. So I can go after higher competition, higher volume content, right? But let's just say if it's a completely, like my sixth site is a baby site, completely new, I would go for, you know, this whole concept of zero volume keywords. I would go for those which are, there's forums on page one, like, you know, I would really go for low competition, low search volume, and really just build trust of Google at the beginning and write maybe like 10 to 20 topics within a cluster to begin with.
Okay, and then you'll move on to the next one after you've done 10 or 20, or would you still continue filling that out?
So it depends on how much I find, right? So if your niche is good and you're good at keyword research, you can go down the rabbit hole. However, obviously you don't want to waste your money, right? Like what if it's, you know, doesn't take off? So I start with maybe 50 to 20 and then I let it just sit there and see if Google sends it love. And just from my experience, Google's always sent it love if it follows the rules, right? If it's low competition, if it's good quality, I've always been fortunate enough that I can rank that content.
Yeah. So often it's subjective, but do you kind of have almost like a framework of what you would consider quality content on your website? Is there, I guess, specific things that must touch on that makes it quality versus maybe a site or a page on another website that's on the SERPs that you would deem low quality? Like, can you articulate those differences for the audience?
Okay, that's a really good question, because I do have a course on it that trains you, but the way that I look at it is, first of all, what are the top 10 or top 20 articles mentioning? Does it have that relevant content? Because Google has ranked that content for a reason, right? Mm. So what are the H2s? What are they included? And then what I do is I mean, there's the quality of it, and there's also including the secondary keywords,
yeah,
which I meant I basically include alternative keywords to rank for, you know, secondary keywords. But the way that I guess it's kind of now more of a gut instinct, I look at it and I say, would I be proud? Would I like to read this?
Yeah.
But it's more or less driven by just seeing if the content has the information, but also going one step further. And so, for example, right, let's say the podcast for the microphones for podcasters. So the top 10 will mention X, Y, and Z, but then maybe I could go one step further and say, what are other challenges that podcasters face? I mean, I'm not a podcaster, you can tell me, right? But what are other problems I can solve? And you can look at the frequently asked, the FAQs, you can answer them, and you can go on forums and just really digging into the thought process of somebody and their pain points. And I feel if you have those, you know, what's on top 10 plus FAQs plus what questions are, and you're going one step beyond, I think you have a solid piece of content, and also grammatically correct.
Yeah. Perfect. So then let's maybe dive a little bit into your keyword research process, and then eventually I want to dive into some more stuff on your first site and then your second site. But your keyword research process, do you have a process down that you use all the time? Do you use specific tools, or are you kind of just going freestyle on Google?
No, I don't do freestyle. I have a process. I've got it for you, actually. Just use this exact process. Yeah, I actually followed this exact process to find 150 keywords across my three sites. So I was ordering more content. And so I actually, as I returned, so I've been off for 2 months, I returned and did keyword research for, and I found 150 low competition keywords. So step one. So depending on your niche, let's just say your niche is rabbits. I don't know, rabbits, by the way, rabbits is a good niche. There's a lot of low competition topics, right? So I take the keyword and I basically start adding keyword modifiers. And so are rabbits, can rabbits, or if it was saying rock climbing for, you know? And so I get these keyword modifiers, and I started using this tool called Keyword Chef. And I've actually really enjoyed using this because it provides content in clusters. So I put the content, I put the question in there, in the wildcard, and I say, for example, are rabbits asterisks, and then it comes up with a cluster. And so I've got that cluster, and I take one of the questions, and then I use a second tool called Key Search. And Key Search is super affordable. It's like less than $17. And so I take that and I put it into Key Search, and I look for a volume of more than 50, competition score of less than 30. Now it's not hard and fast, it's just a rough guide. And so then I look at it and say, okay, so this does have a search, say a search volume of 70, competition score of 21. So that's good. And then what I do is I look at the top 10. And if I can see the domain authorities of the competitors on page one are really low, if they're forums, if it's less than 30, less than 20, and I feel that I can outrank them, I'll take the keyword.
Nice. Okay. So then that's 150 of them that you'll go through and manually look at them in Google as well, just to essentially double check and make sure that it really is low competition.
To be honest, once you've done keyword research long enough, mm-hmm. you have a gut feel for whether it is low competition. I mean, so when say I found a keyword, are rabbits afraid of the dark? if anyone's in the rabbit niche, take that keyword.
Yeah, rabbit niche is my first site, so I'll take that one.
Take that, yeah. I can send you loads more. Honestly, James, you can have them all. So our rabbit's fear of the dark. And then the great thing about key search is on the right section, it gives you alternative keywords in which are different. And then I just click on all of them and then just do a quick check. So it's kind of like in one, honestly, in 10 minutes, you can find loads because you click, look at it, you know, and it shows you on key search in one page, the domains that are less than 20. You don't have to actually manually check it if you don't want to. You can see on the page, okay, that's a forum, that's domain. So it actually becomes quite fast, but, and I really enjoy it. I have to say, out of all the things that I do, I retain the keyword research process.
I was going to ask, do you enjoy it? Because that's the one thing I enjoy, because it's almost, you can almost turn your mind off. You don't have to sit there trying to write something, like really get it nailed down. You just kind of sit there. It's almost relaxing to be able to do something like that, but you're still doing something for the business and pushing it forward.
Right, yeah. Right. But it's dangerous though, James, because I don't know anybody here can relate. They listen to it. You find like 10 different niches you can start and you have to like restrain yourself. Like, yeah. I can't start another niche site, you know? So that's the danger of it.
For sure. I think I've got a list of a few that I'll be like, man, I want to get into these so badly, but time, money, all that stuff. You're like, I should just focus on building the ones that I have that are making money, let them make more money. Don't go starting some random other thing that, you know, you have to find writers for, whatever else.
Yeah, focus. I mean, that's been my biggest challenge, but focus will get you places, to be honest.
Yeah, for sure. I want to jump to your first site quickly. You mentioned it's making like 10 to 15,000 a month. How is that monetized?
So we have ads, affiliates, digital products, and then occasionally I'll run workshops. And I don't know if people agree or disagree, because it's active income. So if active income can be included into the blogging revenue, I mean, it's when it is there, it's good money. So I recently ran, I opened it up. It's quite amazing, actually. If anybody's listened to this, you really should get into running workshops, because I opened it for 45 minutes to the sales and made more than 4,000 USD. In 45 minutes.
Wow.
And so I'm telling you, like, workshops, people are thirsty for knowledge in a workshop format. And a couple of my friends are doing it and they're doing very well, because it's a win-win, right? You're teaching others and it's not an expensive course. It's an affordable workshop and it's on that scale. So yeah, so digital products, affiliates and ads are the main ones. And then sometimes I'll have a cash injection with workshops.
Let's dive into that workshop, because that's interesting. I like that idea. It's, as you mentioned, it's more active, but to me, it's almost like that along with digital products, you're turning yourself into a brand, you're a real business as such, because now you're offering more than just display ads on your website. So then how are you delivering the workshop? Is there a certain maybe tech stack that you're using? And then on the workshop itself, what are you actually delivering to, I guess, the paying customer?
Okay, so it really depends on what they need. So I really, all of my customers or participants come from Instagram. I have a really small but engaged Instagram. You know, it's less than 10,000, but they're amazing. And I know they're listening to this, and, you know, I care about all of you and they care about me. And so often they will communicate with me and reply to me in my stories, and they will say, I'm struggling with this. Like, how do I make money on Amazon affiliates? And, you know, I always try and share, because anybody can claim to earn X, Y, and Z. And so I often share my income screenshots in my stories. It's more private because it's 24 hours.
Yeah.
And so my Instagram community know that I'm not bullshitting, because I've showed them proof, like I earned 2,000 on Amazon for one site. Boom, you can see the proof. And so they will share their struggles. And so I'll do a poll and say, do you want me to run a workshop on Amazon affiliates? Or do you want me to run a workshop on finding a profitable niche? And they'll vote. And then I'll be like, all right, guys, just hold on. I'm gonna open it up tomorrow. Keep your eyes peeled. And then when I open it, they get first dibs, because they're my community. They're watching my stories. I give them first dibs, and then I'll open it up to the public after.
Okay, so then it's a group workshop. Then I'm assuming everyone comes into the same platform. Are you just hosting that on Zoom or anything?
Yeah, just on Zoom. So I have a presentation. So the beauty of these workshops is you've got to teach things you know, like. People struggle, like they say, oh, I don't know what to teach. It's like, just teach what's worked for you. which is so important that you don't bullshit people, right? So I always teach stuff that I'm doing. So I will share the strategy, say if I'm making Amazon affiliate income, I will share, okay, this particular article made me this much, and you share them in your presentation, and I run it on Zoom, and then I basically collect the tickets on Thrivecart.
Oh, nice, nice. That's super simple then. Yeah, I use Thrivecart too. I think probably most people selling digital products use Thrivecart. It's obviously because you got the lifetime deal. You're not paying a subscription to sell your stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. And you'd be surprised, because I feel courses intimidate people, and the course prices intimidate people too. But I feel like personally, when I began, like I think I mentioned before, I was very poor growing up and I didn't have much money. So, and you know, I struggled to learn, because, you know, you can Google all the free stuff and, you know, you don't get anywhere, or it takes a long time. But courses are valuable, but they cost a lot of money. Like some courses out there are like $1,000, right? Workshops, you can charge them, you know, you can start them at 39 to 67, but because you have the scale, it's worth your time, right? So it's a winning, and it's, you know, they're winning, you're winning. And also you get the chance to, you know, keep your ear to the ground and engage with your people rather than just sitting and writing content and not really understanding the true problems people are facing, you know?
Do you think it's also the fact that they almost get FaceTime with you that makes the workshop more attractive than just a course where you're on a screen, they can't really interact, or if they have questions, they have to maybe send an email, and they're like, oh, I've spent $200 on this course, and you know, I've taken some of it, but I don't want to take the rest of it now, etc. Whereas the workshop, they're in 45 minutes, they're with you, and they kind of get that direct interaction.
You know, that's very interesting, because I was trying to work it out, because I was saying to my friend, I was like, my course is the same price. Why is it the workshop was so popular?
And
I mean, I was thinking, is it because of FaceTime? But I don't want to be arrogant. I don't want to assume that people want to see me. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to get caught up and get a big ego. So I thought maybe it's that, maybe it's something else. And then I think maybe you're right. Maybe people need that human interaction and conversation in this world of blogging, because it can get quite isolating. And having somebody to connect with is quite important, right?
Yeah, and maybe because also, like, I guess there's also a stigma. Obviously, there's good courses, but there's also a stigma around, I guess you could say, scammy courses or courses that aren't that good but cost a lot of money. So people maybe are more aware of what's happening in the online course world. And then maybe the workshop kind of gives, you know, you have to present the value on the workshop live. So that must be good, because if you don't present it live, you're not going to be able to keep anyone. So perhaps that's another reason.
Yeah, I mean, I guess also I'm thinking of the workshops that I attend, and I think you're right. It's the being able to connect with somebody and have that access to them, right? Because when you attend my workshops, I know you, I can see your name, I remember you, you know, we're human, we're only human. And so if I've got like 30 messages in my Instagram DMs, and somebody that I know who came to my workshop, paid for my ticket, supported my business, says, hey, I'm really struggling, do you have an answer to this? I'm going to reply to them first, right? I'm only human. And so building that network and connection, I suppose, could also be a factor.
Yeah. And that's obviously good for the bottom line too. You know, you've got always super followers that are ready to buy, you know, whatever it is you're bringing up the next week, the next day, whatever it is.
Yeah, and I think that I feel very privileged, and I never take it for granted, because I remember, and if you're hearing this and wondering, oh, yes, I'm selling my workshop, nobody turned up. For my first workshop, you know, I struggled because I was new, and it's normal, so don't get disheartened. Over time, if you continue to give more value than you charge, like my workshops, I make sure what I provide, I want them to feel like, shit, this was too cheap. That's the feeling that I want them to say, she should have charged more for this. That is a feeling that you need to create, because then they will buy the next one. And my rate of recurrence for my participants is like, they normally buy the next 5. So if they buy the first one, they genuinely, like, I'm looking at their return sales, a lot of them like buy it 5-6 times after. Wow. And so serve your people, serve them, give them more value, be generous, and you will have no problem with earning money.
Yeah, that's how I'm starting to look at things too now, like over deliver on your price. Whatever you're going to price it, figure out a way to deliver more than you would pay, essentially. I don't know if I said that correctly, actually, now. Whatever it is, deliver more than what you would pay for that course. So, or whatever it is. And then at least that way you're in the clear, you know that you're not like delivering almost like a little bit and then charging people. And you almost, as a creator, you can always feel guilty if you start, say you're charging $100 for something, you go, I don't know if this is $100 worth of information or teachings or whatever it is. Whereas if you start delivering, hey, to me, I believe this is $500 worth, it's almost easier on, I guess, yourself as well. And you'll be better at selling it because you know that it's worth a lot of money.
Totally, absolutely. And I think I've seen people who struggle with, you know, there's conflicting advice, right? Because people say, don't underprice yourself, you know? There's that common, and you know, especially as a female, we often do this, we underprice ourselves, but like there's that worry, like, oh, I'm underpricing myself to always want to give value, but there's a fine balance. And I think, obviously I wouldn't like do it too cheap, so I'm not, you know, valuing my skills, but at the same time, also I want them to feel like, wow, I'm special, I'm lucky I got in.
Yeah, I think it's too cheap as well, it makes the product look cheap. That's the other issue.
Yeah.
So if you're charging $7 for a workshop, then it's kind of like, you know, what am I going to get out of this workshop?
Yeah, what's the mistake here? What's going on? Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I want to change chat a little bit to your second site. So how many sites do you have in your portfolio now?
Six.
Okay.
But so I'm actively growing three. Passively growing the remaining three, but actively growing three.
Okay, before I go to the second site then, you've obviously got a team of writers. How many writers do you have? This is going to be a lot of questions, so I'll circle back to them as well if we don't get through them all. How many writers do you have? How do you hire them? And then, I guess, how do you train them, or do you need to train them?
Okay, right. I've written this down so we don't miss it. Okay, so my model is slightly different, and some might not agree with it, but it works for me. Okay, so I have quite a large team. I have about 41 writers.
Oh, wow.
And the reason why it's quite a big team is I don't just hire people who are writers. Because if you want to go the efficient way, the business model way, you'd hire writers who can write a lot of content, right? So one writer can write 10, 20, as much as possible. But my model is more to do with upskilling my community. And a lot of the people in my community are moms, parents, students, and they're holding down full-time jobs and they can't write 10 articles, but they still want to better their lives and upskill. And so they can commit to maybe one or two a month, but when they commit to it, it's good because they know that I'm giving them opportunity. And so I do run a big team, but not everybody can write at the scale that a traditional writer can write, but the quality is excellent. I have to say,
I'm with you on that. Like, I don't hire writers or SEO writers. I only hire the industry expert or whatever in my field, in the field that I'm in. So for example, health and fitness, I have coaching friends and blah, blah, blah. Even though they're not writers, I hire them because they know the topic. And then if it needs editing, I'll edit it. But I want the topic expertise. I don't give a shit if it has that specific keyword in it and it's got these whatever, because I'm going to do the brief anyway.
Right. I mean, and they can be trained, like they can be trained up to write SEO.
Writing. Exactly.
That makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
So go on.
No, you, I think we had, I guess we covered kind of how you hire them. Yeah, because they're part of your community.
So I hire them through my workshops. And so what I do is I run freelance. One of the many workshops I run, one of them is freelance writing workshops, because I used to work as a freelance writer. And the biggest struggle as a new freelance writer is, how do I go from no experience, no contacts in the community, totally untrained, to earning money for my writing? Yeah. It's like that jump is so big, right? How do you make that jump? And I teach them that jump. How do you go? Because I was there. How do you go from right now, no experience, no writing income, no context. How do you go from here to earning from your writing? And I teach them in that workshop. And then I invite them to pitch to me, and I give them a template on how they should pitch. And the best ones then progress through the process. And so I ask them to pitch to me, then I give them training on the outline. So they pitch to me, I review the pitch, and I say, okay, here's video training using Loom on the outline, how to write an outline. And then they write the outline, and I will so a lot of it is already done. So the Loom training, and then I review the outline, approve it. I mean, I give them the keyword, and then they write the content. Once they write the content, when it's done, it gets reviewed. So I used to do a lot of that, but I have an editor now who handles them, and she's amazing. And so I only hire people from my workshops. I only promote people from my team. I don't hire from outside. So my VA, my Pinterest VA, you know, everybody in my team has come from my workshops because I want to reward people who supported me and serve my community.
Awesome. I think that's like even coming from someone, so these people don't come from, I guess, writing backgrounds, and even for myself, like I still do some writing for different like fitness, sports science publications just because it's good for the personal brand and career and all that stuff. But at that time, I never knew you could even make money writing, you know? And it's eye-opening. So when you're doing these workshops, I'm sure a lot of these people are like, holy shit, I can sit at home, write an article, and then make, you know, X amount of money, you know? That's a big, I guess, big selling point on your side too.
Yeah, and I think the biggest selling point is not many people, I don't know anybody that can guarantee them work, right? So a lot of the times these courses and this training, they teach them and they're like, all right, you're on your own. And that's what I had to go through. I did a course and it's like, okay, now I'm gonna find clients.
Who do I write for?
And so I provided that, and that's where we come into my second site. I noticed there's a gap because a lot of these writers have no portfolio. They have nothing to show clients. I was like, I feel really bad for them, you know, like how can I bridge that gap? And so I set up the second site for them to have a portfolio to show to other clients as featured on. And so it's a training ground for them. And then also, like, I often, like, I'm on a content hiring spree. I've got six sites, right? Yeah. And so I think that, like, I say to them, if you're good, if you follow the rules and you know, you're not a complete idiot, you know, if you just do your best, you can have as much work as you want. Right, so that is a huge incentive for people to come to the workshops and do their best.
That's really good. Does that mean that your niche sites are in niches that maybe these people would be some or have some knowledge in? Because you mentioned it was like stay-at-home moms and things like that potentially. Does that mean your niche site, like, it can't be in, say, tech or something like that that maybe is too technical for them?
No, because I truly believe, and this is my experience as a freelance writer, you can write on a topic even if you don't have experience, if you are a good writer and you know how to research. And so, for example, I wrote about Everest, climbing up to Everest base camp when I'd never climbed up to Everest base camp. I did all my research. I enjoyed it so much, I ended up climbing to Everest base camp later on.
Following your own guide.
You know, I mean, honestly, yeah. So it was like, it was really satisfying. And so I say to them, there are certain niches, maybe, I guess I don't have any in the health niche because I think YML is tough. And I do also think you've got to be careful when giving health advice. I don't want that on my conscience. But as a whole, like, there are topics which a lot of my writers say, oh, I don't have experience. Don't care. As long as you know how to research and find good information, I don't care if you don't have experience. It doesn't matter.
Nice. Okay, that makes sense. And then I guess because you've got so many, I guess this comes down to the managing part of the writers. Because you have, I guess, so many writers, so many sites, everything, do you just have them all access the same, say, Google Sheet with a list of keywords and they kind of pick as they are, please?
No. So what I do is I find the keywords, right? And then I will decide who gets what keywords. So this is where I still want to be involved because I know my writers. I just know. I know the expertise. I know the behaviors. And even though I have an editor who manages them, I still try. Like, on Instagram, it's quite easy. You can send a voice note. You can connect with people very quickly. And so I just know. I just know, based on reading their articles, what they're good at, what they're not good at. And so, and also rewarding those who have performed well. So those who have performed well, they get the cool topics. And so it really is, yeah, it's about, like, rewarding those who put your business first. And, you know, it's a give and take, right? And so I will go and I will assign. And also the price. Like, I don't have a consistent price. Like, I start them on a rate that's the same, but depending on how good or bad they are or how much work they need, their rate increases or doesn't change. So I will decide that and I will just quickly put it. I mean, it took me, what, 2-3 hours to do 150, you know, keywords. And then I will give that sheet to my editor who then sends it out to the writers and takes it from there.
Nice. I like that idea. I guess not an idea. I guess it's just good business practice, to be honest. But like... treating your writers like almost like your friends, but like the part of the business. Like, for example, you mentioned they started on the base rate, you increase their rates depending on their performance, stuff like that. I've got one writer that I've kept on now for maybe over a year. He's had like 4 or 5 pay rises. I just sent him training gear the other day from a company that reached out so we could review it. So he's stoked, he gets free training gear. He's like, I've always wanted to be able to write for a site and get free gear and all this blah blah blah. So that's, you know, be able to do stuff like that. And then and the same thing you mentioned about knowing kind of their skills, I guess, as a writer and their topic, I guess, expertise as well. I know which articles that he writes really, really well. And then obviously I can, if I have another writer come in, then the other writer can kind of pick up the slack, or maybe some of the other ones that maybe, you know, he's had this, he's got this many stuff or this much stuff to write, but the new writer can kind of pick up the slack with articles that I know that this writer may not be as good at as well. So like you mentioned, like you got that team and you're able to almost work to every single person's strength within all those keywords. And that just increases the quality of your content dramatically.
Totally. And people think, oh, does that take up a lot of your time? And actually, no, I think if you care about your people, then it doesn't feel like work, you know, like I just enjoy, like, you know, I know if say someone's been off, I'll message, like, even though I don't want to overstep my editor, she's in charge of them. If someone hasn't been performing, I'll let her know. I'm going to touch base with them. And maybe I'll send them an Instagram message and say, hey, is everything okay? Like, I just noticed that your writing's not the same. Is there anything going on? And 9 times out of 10, there's some shit going on in their life. And you're like, hey, okay, I get it. This is my standard. This is what I need. But I'm here to support you. Let me know how I can support you. And just having that conversation, I think, makes a big difference, because, you know, we're all human. And I was a writer too. And, you know, someone showed me compassion. So when we show compassion, then they will respect and want to work with your business, for your business, better, I think.
Have you had to let writers go? And if so, how?
Yes, it's rare, but I have. I mean, the writers that... Okay, so there's two types of writers I let go. The one where it's easy for me to let go, and one where I struggle. So the one where it's easy to let go is they don't follow the deadline. They don't meet the deadline, and they don't do the bare minimum. So I'm very clear in the workshop. Yeah. These are the bare minimum. Meeting deadlines, following instructions. So if they don't meet the deadline, or there's any, like... nonsense, I say it. Like, I think you go in there with respect and kindness and compassion, but you're running a business. And you, if you don't protect your business, if you don't put your business first, you won't have money to pay your writers. And so I think people, they get surprised because they see I'm nice and I smile, but then when shit hits the fan, I want to know why you haven't hit the deadline. And it's okay to do that. It doesn't make you a bad person. You've been very clear about your boundaries. And so that's easy for me. It's like, well, you didn't give me notice why you couldn't meet the deadline. Can't work with you, all the best. The ones that I struggle to let go are where they're good, but the writing grammar is just not there. Mm. It's like, it's taking my editor much longer to edit their content. And she's amazing. She says, I don't mind doing it. But as my team member, I also need to respect her time, right? And if it's taking her longer, it's putting her under pressure, taking up her time. And so I'll try and give them a development email. I say, these are the things I need to change. I need to see change. If you can't improve that, then unfortunately I'll have to let you go. But I stay in very good contact with them. I'm on good terms with them. And I still often, like the recent one, I sent her like some keywords I found, you know, so we leave on good terms. But
yeah,
I'm very clear with my boundaries and my writers, which is important.
Yeah. Do you pay them hourly per article, or you're looking per word?
Per article.
Yeah. I like that model too. When you're paying per word and then you edit it, and then obviously you take out a whole lot of fluff or whatever it is, then it's incentivizes, I guess, fluffing it out, even if you want to put your instructions to not to, but I think per article, if you average it out over the long term, you're going to hit whatever 1,000-1,500 words anyway. So it kind of makes it a little easier.
Something also to bear in mind, which if anybody here is going to be running their own team, is there's going to be an upper limit that you're going to hit with what you can pay, right? Because we are running these, well, I am running these as niche sites. It's not just one blog I'm running. I'm running many blogs. And so I have to factor the cost, right? So there's going to be a point where your best writers, you can't pay them more than what you can afford, right? You know, you know, I try my best. And it's actually recognizing that you've skilled them up to that point and wishing them the best of luck. So a lot of them still stay with me because I often still continue to teach them SEO. That's the benefit of writing for my team, is I teach them all the latest strategies. They're like, you're not just a writer. I will make sure that you know how to write content that can rank. So they actually just stay with me to learn, to continue learning. And I also often send them clients because people ask me, how do you have any writers? And if someone's like hit the maximum, we're on good terms, they're respectful, they do one or two, you know, a month, but that's it. I'm okay to send them other clients that pay way more. But yeah. It's being okay with that. I used to feel really bad. And I'm like, oh, what if I'm being selfish? You know, like, should I pay them more? But, you know, if you pay that, then, the revenue drops, and then maybe not, you know, you've got to factor in cash flow and all that. And you need to be make sure that, like, I never pay my writers late. It's a big, big value of mine, you know? Like, if somebody has worked for you and you've committed to pay them on time. The bare minimum, pay them on time.
I agree with you that 100%. I like that you brought that up about the upper limit of pay, because that's something that I know I'm going to have to contend with soon. But I think things like you mentioned about being able to offer them more work, or other things like I mentioned about they get free gear, whatever it is, stuff like that, I think kind of helps sweeten the deal a little bit. And almost like giving them the flexibility to write almost as they please as well kind of gives them more incentive to stay. You almost got to offer more than just money to your good writers.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, personally, I just think for me, like, if I have like my best writers, I want them to like be at the forefront of my mind when there's opportunities, first of all. And then, you know, they can, in a way, like, they get free coaching. Like, they can come into my DMs and say, I'm struggling with this client, or how do I do that? Everybody else, they have to pay for my coaching, but I don't open my coaching. Once a year I open in, that's it. They can come directly to me and get free advice. And that is a huge pulling factor, I think. I mean, they might disagree with me, I don't know. But I think that, I hope, I mean, that seems to be working. But also, you know, don't just wish them best of luck. There's no bad blood. If somebody can't work for you anymore because you can't pay what they charge, it's okay. That's okay. You've got to wish them the best. You've got to let your baby, you know, let them spread their wings and then wish them the best of luck.
Yeah. No, that's great advice for anyone listening who has a team of writers or is building their team of writers. But I want to dive into a little bit of your second site. So do you want to maybe jump into maybe how old it is, how many articles, current revenue, just the general outline of the site now?
Okay. Also, if you see my cat, I hope it's okay. She's called Supervisor Sandy. She's a tyrant. She's an absolute tyrant. And I was trying to close the doors because I didn't want the noise to come in, and she screamed the house down. So if you hear her, I'm really sorry, but she's just supervising.
She's your manager there.
She basically takes a break from her 8-hour lunch break to tell me to work harder. That's her. That's my cat.
That's a good manager.
Okay. Because she thinks so. Okay, so my second site is, I started it at the end of 2020. So I'd say, like, I didn't really put content. So let's just say start of 2021. So what is that? 20 months? Is that right? So 21, 12.
Give or take, yeah.
yeah. So I actually started that while I was on a motorbike trip with my brother through Malaysia, and I was I want something so my writers have something to call their own on this, you know, for their portfolio. So I just set it up. It now has 406 posts. Revenue is just under 2,500, and traffic is 41,000 page views, and revenue comes from ads and Amazon affiliates, but I'm looking to diversify the affiliates. That's my next step.
Oh, nice. I was going to ask you, so what's the future plan to grow that site to maybe the numbers that your first site's at?
Right. So first and foremost, I need to make sure that I diversify my affiliates, because it is a risk to rely on one affiliate, especially if it's Amazon affiliates, right? I mean, everybody talks about it.
Yeah.
And so, I know I need to do this, and I will do it. So what I'm going to do, I mean, I can share the niche. It's in the travel niche, if anybody wants to know, yeah? So it's in the travel niche. And so specific affiliates that I'm going to try, and you guys can try yourself, I'm going to be getting into Viator, Get Your Guide, Agoda, Rental Cars, and Expedia.
Damn, that sounds lucrative.
And what I'll do, right? And so I already have traffic to posts where these, I can just embed them, right? So I have a lot of info posts, and so I'm gonna go to Search Console, find content that's getting traffic, and then I'm gonna take these affiliate links and I'm gonna put them in those top form posts. Hopefully that will convert. I mean, that's what I did for Amazon. So if it worked for Amazon, hopefully it can work for these two.
That's interesting because I'm thinking now travel niche. If you're doing an affiliate, say for Expedia, I think some of those other companies must be maybe like booking trips and stuff like that. Obviously, that's different to Amazon products. So are these going to be different posts on the site then that you're adding these in and you're still going to have the Amazon ones? Or is there some kind of crossover where you're replacing Amazon links with some of these?
No, so firstly, I will go to the info post. So none of my info posts, well, some of my info posts, a lot of my info posts have Amazon products in. I make sure I monetize each post.
Oh, okay.
But what I'll do is, so every single post has an Amazon link
Wow.
because, that's how I get Amazon income. You've got to just think about the pain points of the reader. Even if they're Googling an info piece of content, they have pain points which you can satisfy with Amazon products. And so I will go to the info content and say, okay, here are the links that I had before, just switch them to affiliate links. And hopefully that should give me some diversification of revenue. I don't know, we could talk in 6 months. I'm like, I didn't learn any of the things. Help me out, bro.
So then I guess on the info page, obviously you have Expedia links and things like that. Is it relatively, I guess you haven't done it yet, but I'm assuming you've maybe looked at other sites that do this stuff. Is it relatively easy then just to be like, hey, this is maybe the 10 best places to visit in whatever city or country? And then just to throw an Expedia box, hey, book your next trip in here. Have you seen that work maybe on other sites well, or is that something you're looking to do on your site that you think would do well? Or is there another way to go about, I guess, sending your prospective lead through to these booking, I guess, affiliates?
Okay, let's talk about let's be practical. Give me an info topic in the travel niche, and I'll teach you how. Oh, I'll share how
Okay.
I would monetize it.
Would oh, I guess that's a listicle, right? If I did 10 best places in a city instead of, but that's still information,
Okay,
right?
okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So 10 best places in New York.
Ten.
10 best cafes in New York in winter.
Yep. All right.
Right. Okay. That is the perfect info. That is the perfect piece of content where you can monetize with Amazon and with those other affiliates I talked about. So 10 best cafes in New York in winter. When you mention those cafes, you've got to look to see the location, right? So I would immediately look for hotels on booking.com or Expedia or Agoda that are near that location. So let's just say 10 best restaurants. I would say right under that first cafe, looking to extend your stay or looking to check out other cafes. This is the best budget combination I found. Looking for something more upmarket, this has the best jacuzzi. What if you want to treat your girl, and this is, and I would make it more relevant because that is something I look for when I go to places. That's exactly what I look for. I look for different budgets. And then with that same article, if it's in the winter, what are the pain points of
Oh,
somebody in
okay.
winter in New York,
That
right?
just clicked for
And
me in
so
my
I'm
head now.
thinking,
I was like, wait, what products are you actually promoting on a cafe blog? And now I understand.
So chances are somebody who's Googling best cafes in New York in the winter, we'll generalize here, could be somebody who loves coffee, they love books, they probably have like to dress a certain way, they love jacket. I don't know, I have no idea. Like, you could find things that they would need in the winter in New York and say, want to make sure you look fashionable, warm, and or like you can get these like super soft kind of socks that you can wear in the winter. Oh, they're so good. So you can just recommend those, like the super soft, fluffy socks, retain and antibacterial, sustainable too. I guarantee someone will click on that. And even if they don't buy it, they're going to Amazon anyway.
So then how are you structuring that post? Because I can imagine if you had, say, 10 cafes, and under the first cafe you have, this is the hotel closest to that cafe, it's the best budget one, there may be more experience or more expensive or luxury. And then you have the one with the best jacuzzi, whatever. And then you also have winter gear. I'm assuming that's not all under the cafe, because otherwise your first cafe post will be huge. Then you've got the rest. Are you kind of like doing another section at the bottom of the page where it's like, hey, don't forget your winter gear or whatever?
Okay, so this is how I would structure it. So let's say 7 best cafes. I would first of all bullet. I would put the 7 summary at the top because I really hate it when you go to an article and you just want the summary. Sometimes you don't want to read the whole post. Give them the summary. Okay, some people say, "Oh, that's off." That's fine. You need to serve your reader first. So I put the 7 best cafes in a bullet point. So that's satisfying their user intent. Underneath that, I would put the Amazon products. Looking to keep warm, these socks. Looking to keep trendy, this coat. Then I would go to the first cafe. Mm-hmm. The first cafe, the location, address, what to order, what I recommend. You want to stay the night? I'd recommend maybe one or two places. Or you could recommend a tour, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't only have to be accommodation. If they're into cafes, maybe they want to do a book tour near the area, then you could mention a tour that Viator can provide.
So you do that under each cafe? So they would have their own kind of hotel recommendation or tour recommendation or whatever?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. I could see that making a lot of money then on a post like that if you got that ranking.
I haven't implemented this, by the way. This is, for me, in theory, how I'm doing it, right? So do you see any downsides to that? Do you see any risks to that from your experience?
I don't see any downsides to it. You've just got extra links on there that can take people essentially to get cookied on their browser when they're looking. Because if you're already looking for whatever it is in that city, you're already planning a trip to go there, assuming, or you're a local that lives there, but then obviously you're not looking to probably target maybe a local, maybe that page isn't for someone local. You're looking for someone who's traveling there anyway. So I don't know, it's probably going to take some testing on your side.
Yeah. I mean, and often there is content which is, specific, like the actual place, can be turned into affiliate link. A lot of places, activities, you can find them on Viator.
Okay.
So that's another thing that I'm going to do. So rather than adding more affiliate links and locations, I would just turn that activity that I recommended into an affiliate link.
Like go rock climbing in New York or whatever, and their place has it. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So location one, location two. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, very nice. So then are all your, I guess, your portfolio sites, are they all under, I guess, your name, or are they kind of like your personal brand, or are certain sites like you don't have your name face on them at all?
So this is a good question, because my fifth site, my fifth site is not under my name, but I purchased that one. So my third site, it was under my name. So that site, actually, I shared it with my brother, my younger brother. So I wanted to, he doesn't know, he's not on social media, so he has no idea what it is. I wanted to do this, but I wanted to gift him once I sold it, and I wanted to help him buy land, because it's just, my younger brother. And so I was basically, I had our pictures on there, and I remember like someone saying, oh, you should take pictures off, blah, blah, blah. So I took it off and replaced it. And I don't know if it's a coincidence, but I got hit by a Google update about a few days later. And so I don't know if the EAT was affected and it messed up the authority of the site or whatever. It could be other factors, but none of my other sites got hit. And that was the only site I tinkered with the About Me page. And I do think that like Google does the quality raters. They do verify your social profiles and want to see if you're a real person, if it all adds up. And so I don't know, maybe that happened, maybe it didn't.
Yeah, gotcha. And I guess are all these sites started on brand new domains? Do you ever dabble with expired or aged domains with your sites?
Okay, so no, I don't, but I'd like to in the future. So the fourth one, I bought that one. So that was a starter site.
Yeah.
And my fifth one was also a starter site. Sixth one, brand new. But looking, based on the performance of the fourth and on the fifth, I think a brand new domain, actually, I could rank faster. Because with a starter site, you don't really get that much of an advantage, Like, if it's more well-established with a high authority, then you have an advantage. But if it's a starter site, the domain's not very high. To be honest, the content is never how I want it to be.
100%, I was going to say.
Right? Yeah, and so I feel like I have to go back and fix everything, which takes me more time. And so with that knowledge now, I mean, I'm determined to make a success of them. I can't give up on them yet. So, watch your space, James. So I'm going to be working on those sites, and my intention will be to sell them, finally get them to a point where they're profitable, sell them. And then if I'm going to if I'm going to set up new sites, either brand new or established, and I would pay the price for, I'd pay more, but make sure that I have that authority and experience behind it.
Yeah. Like going back and kind of redoing someone else's content is 10 times harder and takes 10 times longer than just rewriting it yourself. It is such a mission.
Yeah. And then you've got to like, think of their clusters and think about, you just got to really, and something that actually that I made this mistake and I'm happy to share it. So it was a starter site, it was quite cheap, content looked okay. And I didn't realize actually later on what the issue was. And I was like, why is this content not ranking? What's the issue? It's a low competition niche. And it was really frustrating me. So I took time to actually go through properly. And I was reading the content and I was like, I get it, the penny dropped. None of the content matched the user intent. Mm. It was just fluff. And I think, I mean, I don't use AI, but I have no issue. I know people have a big thing against it. I think if you modify it enough, you can get, you know, I have a lot of friends that use AI that do well. So I could see that a lot of the content was AI, but it hadn't really been modified. And so, for example, let's just say, how to fix a broken zip, right? Instead of saying step one, step two, step three to fix a broken zip, they would go like, in Zimbabwe, zips can be defined as this.
Why is
in
it Australia, so
yeah, and it's like, I got really frustrated reading the content, and I understood now the importance of matching the user intent as soon as possible. So if you are listening to this, whenever you write content, find out what the user intent is, first of all, and you do that by looking at page one, because what you think and what Google think could be something different. So eat, pray, love, you might be talking about eating, praying, and loving. Google thinks it's a movie. So if you write about eating, praying, and loving, Google's not going to rank your content. He's going to rank the movie. So find out what the user intent is and go about matching that user intent ASAP in the best way possible. That's how you rank content.
Nice. That's great advice. And I wanted to go into, because you mentioned obviously most of your domains are new. Do you then have an off-page strategy for maybe getting links, whether that's, I don't know, buying, Harrow, whatever it is, or you just focus on the content and that's all you care about?
Okay, I like this question. So there's a big debate of, you know, do links matter? Links matter, okay? Let us not hide from the fact that links matter. Everybody can argue or decide, I believe that links matter. But whether you do it, whether you think it's worth your time is a different story. So at the beginning, I don't do off-page SEO at the beginning because I'm getting the content velocity, okay? Yes, you can be very successful and earn a lot of money with on-page SEO. However, if you want to protect yourself and have a protective moat and hold it for the long term and see it as an asset, I do think there's value in building links. So what I will be doing for my first site, I built links. I used to be a freelance writer. I would be referenced in a lot of my writing, so I got natural backlinks. So what I did for my second site, and well, I don't do it as much now, but I will continue to do for my other sites, is I will go on Facebook and I will put in the niche collabs, the niche link swaps, and you go in there. And there are people in these Facebook groups who are looking for you to offer them guest posts and give one back. And I would probably do guest posts that way. And the beauty of serving first is if you do a really good job for that blogger, they will allow you to write content for your other blogs, right? And link to your other blogs. And so, I mean, touch wood, touch wood, every single guest post I've written, they've come back to me and said, shit, I'm getting a lot of traffic. And it makes me happy because if they're happy and they're getting traffic, I can say, thanks, can I write another piece but link to my third site? 10 out of 10 doesn't yes, right? And so I would, back in the day, you could pitch for guest posts, it's harder. So now I think it's about leveraging on your community, going to Facebook groups, speaking to other bloggers. And that's what I would do.
Are you writing the content for those guest posts or your writers are doing that?
It's my writers, but me heavily involved. So okay. I'm way more heavily involved in the guest post than I am. Sometimes I write it too. Like I've written a few because I want to make sure my skills are relevant. So a few of the recent ones I've written myself.
Yeah.
But if I'm writing a guest post, it needs to be better than it would be on my site. Mm. You know, you have to respect the other site. You're a guest, right? So I make sure that I maybe get to do the research, but I go in there. And if, say, it's somebody who's like quite important to me, I write it myself because I want to make sure it's perfect.
Yeah.
What about you?
For guest posts, yeah, I mean, I write all my own content basically anyway as well, just because that's kind of like my expertise. And then if I'm writing for another site, it's usually for example, there's Science for Sport, TNation.com, something like all those kind of bigger fitness sites, all I guess they aggregate coaches from around the world. They write content for them, And so it's kind of like in your name. So I'm not going to have someone try write something for me on a technical topic. And then it's like, what the hell is this?
especially for your niche, I think it's important that, you know, like, so for example, finance, I have experience in finance. If it was to do with finance topics, I'd write it myself.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've got to make sure you're giving the reader the right experience. And so it depends on the niche. Like, if the niche is not technical, and if the I don't really know them that well, if it's like a friend I'm guest posting on or somebody that I completely care about, I will do it, you know, out of respect. But also, you just get yourself heavily involved if it's you're outsourcing it.
Yeah, for sure. I guess to finish up this podcast, there might be people listening to this and they go, Aisha, you're killing it. You have a whole team, making heaps of money, you're traveling, you're doing what many people are trying to achieve with their websites, that is being a digital nomad, basically, and just living and working anywhere. It's easy for you. And for the people, maybe they're just starting out, they're unsure of how to get started, maybe just like start writing the first lots of content, but now feeling demotivated, not seeing the results. What advice do you have for people maybe in this situation?
Gosh, I mean, first of all, it didn't come easy. Like, I had to fail. People think this, you know, I'm very fortunate. I took 2 months off and you see the good side, but, you know, and if you are on my Instagram, do follow me. It's Aisha Priest. I share the dark side too. Like, you don't see the times when you get hit by a Google update. So my third site, which I wanted to give to my brother, that got hit. And it went from $500 a month to nothing. And I felt like such a failure. Like, I'm his big sister. I'm supposed to be... I just felt like such a failure. And just recognize that we all go through these periods and you're not alone. But my advice is to hold your nerve, because this industry rewards those who are the most resilient, okay?
Yeah.
Only those who can hold the nerve, suck it up, keep publishing content are the ones that will get there to the end. Like, the way that you can guarantee failure is to give up, right? And so just know that, you know, you're not alone. If you want to reach out to me on Instagram, send me a message, you know, so you feel less alone. And just hold your nerve. And finally, this is a big one for me that really has resonated with me is, and it sounds a bit morbid, is nobody died. Like, I have a feeling in this industry, it's like Google update, wrong keyword research, rah, rah, rah. And it's like, hold up, everybody. You didn't get X, Y, and Z done, but nobody died. You have your family, you have your health, you have your brain, you can recover. The world and the economy and blogging is cyclical. And so nobody died, keep at it, stick at it, and you will get there. And you're not alone.
Perfect. That's great advice as well. Before we go, I have one question for you on your site that got hit. Do you have a plan to help recover that site?
Yes.
Are you willing
to
share?
Okay, so I'll
show you. Yeah. All right, so, that's the podcast done, guys. That's the answer.
Okay, so step one. What I'm going to do is I'm going to improve the social signals. And so I'm going to add more pictures of me and my brother. I'm going to add a LinkedIn profile, a YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. I'm going to make sure that Google knows it's me and I'm real, number one. Number two, I'm going to go to every single piece of content that got hit, the top 10 that got hit, and I'm going to look at them and take a moment to understand, like, what can I improve? And the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to add original images. I think a lot of the time, Google sometimes thinks, I don't know if I trust this article. Like, I've seen this image many, many times. And so I will try and add as many original images as I can, the product or of the info, the place. And number three is I'm definitely going to add some backlinks. I'm going to go on some blogging groups and start like offering guest posting and improving the domain authority. And then after that, you've just got to, number four, I'm going to be publishing a lot of content on there. So I was listening to a podcast recently. I think it was Mike, I think it was on Niche Pursuits, and he got hit by Google update, Mike Dinesh or something. And he said, when people get hit, they get stopped in the tracks and they say, give up, cancel the software. But he said, that is the time you need to knuckle down. That is the time that you need to really push content. And so I've ordered 50 pieces and I'm going to have 50 pieces of content on that site. Now, if I've done all that, then James, I can't do anything more. You know what I mean? Like, I've really done the best I can. Then maybe we'll chat in a year's time or 6 months and you're like, well, how did it go? And then we'll take it from there. You can only do your best. You know what I mean?
And then you got to light some candles and do a little spiritual ritual for the Google gods. And then it might work.
Go on. go on Twitter and declare blogging is dead, you know, the usual stuff.
Oh, perfect. Is there, I guess you mentioned your Instagram, is there maybe, do you want to rattle off some of your socials where people can find you?
Yeah, so my Instagram is Aisha Priest, AISHAPREECE. And then I'm also on Twitter. The best way to get hold of me is Instagram. I don't know if I can give you guys a free checklist to, if you want to join my email community, if you'd like to, you can. Mm-hmm. I share tips every Wednesday. For example, today, I actually shared with screenshots my keyword research process. And so every Wednesday, I share a lot of my strategy. And so I think the best, those are the three main ways, Twitter, my email community, my email list, and my Instagram. And my Instagram is the best way because I can send voice notes and keep it personal.
Perfect. All right. So if anyone listening, you can follow Aisha on those platforms, get to know her processes, speak to her on a DM if you need to on Instagram as well. Join her workshops, of course, because you're going to learn a lot. And other than that, thanks for coming on, Aisha. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for the time, James. I hope to see you again in the future. Best of luck with everything. And thanks, everybody, for listening.
Yeah, cheers.
Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you're listening. Until the next episode, goodbye.